Hi, David.
Good to see you again, so to speak, on Blogging Heads TV. It's been a couple of weeks. There are lots going on, and this is, I guess, our pre-election special, and it's a special day. This is the first anniversary of the very first Blogging Head episode featuring Mickey Kouse and our venerable founder, Bob Wright.
How about that? These anniversaries have a way of creeping up on you. What is like the one-year anniversary, like the paperclip anniversary or something? Moving up to diamonds and silver, but we'll get there.
And I actually have something that you won't be able to see until you watch this, but I ran into Mickey Kouse on Halloween, and I'm holding up now the very wig that he was wearing. And I want people to sort of imagine Mickey Kouse in this wig. Maybe we'll see it on a future Blogging Head episode. And then again, maybe not. I've already have blogged on the John Kerry Tempest in a Teapot this week, saying that I thought it's been overplayed, but I guess we really have to start with it.
Right, and I wrote my column on it today at Newsday.com.
Look for the links to the side.
Right.
You people know how to do that. And I've been running around today. I haven't read yours. I had a few different lines on this. One was, I didn't think what he said to begin with was all that bad. I mean, troops are stuck in Iraq right now, and it does turn out, according to my figures I have here from the Army, I'm looking at them right now, that 83% of the enlisted troops have high school diplomas or less, do not have college diplomas. So it seems that if you study hard, go to college, the odds are that you won't end up being stuck in Iraq. And that aside, regardless of whether this was a botched joke or not, it seems to me, too, that the real serious matter this week is what's actually happening in Iraq, not what John Kerry has to say to a bunch of students when he's trying to make a joke on Bush. And what a surprise. The White House sees it differently.
Well, let's save Iraq, the actual merits of the war itself, until last. Let's do the easy stuff first. Number one, I don't believe Kerry was making a joke at Bush's expense on Monday in Pasadena. I think he was said exactly what he said, which is, if you students study hard, you won't have to go fight in Iraq. I think that's literally what he said. And I think, so therefore, the joke was clearly at the expense of American soldiers and Marines and airmen in Iraq. And I think it just is a window, and the reason why this thing caused such a firestorm, the reason why it led the broadcast, not Fox News, but the broadcast news channels two nights running, was because people understood full well this sort of comes out of John Kerry's married a billionaire, limousine liberal, Beacon Hill view of the world, where only, in his view, dopes and undereducated people and the occasional warmonger would join the military. And the small R Republican idea that you fight for your country, even if you don't agree with the war, is completely lost on Kerry.
But did you not see the transcript of the speech that the Kerry people released? There were three or four jokes at the beginning. This was one of the four jokes, and then he said, "Okay, seriously now." And then he got into the speech, and he did. And in the transcript that they released, it did say, "You'd get us stuck in Iraq. Just ask President Bush." So it's from the transcript, it's one of three or four, Bush jokes told in a row, some of which he did tell, and he didn't say it the way it was written in the speech.
Well, that's interesting. However, what you can't do in this world, and it's just a lesson in politics, to all those aspiring politicos out there in Blogging Heads TV land, you can never, ever be seen as being critical of the American armed services. Right. If you want to then become commander-in-chief, you can say, the First Amendment guarantees your right to say whatever you want, but the American people aren't going to elect you if they think that you're looking down your long nose at the troops.
But of course, I mean, it's an obvious, easy point here that John Kerry did serve to choose. And he did it, in a combat situation. Bush flew in the Champagne Brigade of the National Air Reserve, and Dick Cheney got five deferrals. I mean, if there's anybody who sort of has a feel and respect for troops, you know, it's John Kenny, John Kerry, and just sort of, you know, I think you're being a little hyperbolic to say that he's a, you know, he has this limousine liberal view of the world because he married an heiress, and this is where this is coming from. This is a guy, every biography of him, and it makes clear that the seminal part of his life, the transforming part of his life, was his service in Vietnam, which is something you can't say about George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Karove, and many of the others.
John Ashcroft, to go down the list. Nothing I'm saying here is intended to say to reflect favorably on Bush, Cheney, Rove, any of those people. Nothing here at all. So I'm not going to argue the merits at all. And I'll even give you this. Of course, John Kerry deserves enormous credit for volunteering to, you know, he left the Navy, left being on a destroyer in the Navy, which is a perfectly safe place to be in Vietnam, to go be on a swift boat in the war. And of course, he deserves enormous credit for that. But equally obviously, since in the 37 years since he came back from Vietnam and married not just one heiress but two heiresses, his worldview has changed. That's pretty clear. And what the problem that a lot of liberal Democrats have is that when they come from places like Massachusetts and Minnesota and so on, they get lazy. They have adoring audiences who listen to any platitude they might say about national health insurance or higher taxes or McGovernism, and applaud rapturously. And they've never really had the experience of dealing with sort of red state contradictory points of view. And so Kerry, I think that was the unpleasant surprise for Kerry, was when he finally left Massachusetts to go run for president, he had the sort of horrible experience of discovering people who just simply didn't agree with him.
Well, listen, he got 48% of the vote.
if it had been Richard Gephardt, I think it would have been a majority for the Democrats.
That we can never know.
True. But I think the point is Kerry...
Let me give you a question. Okay. Do you think the media embrace of this story, as you said, it led the broadcast news reports, and it was, of course, all over cable news, was in proportion to the reality itself. We saw far more coverage in the last 2 days of this one sentence than we saw of anything coming out of Iraq. I tend to think that's not proportionate. What do you think?
I think Iraq ought to get, if it's American blood involved and it's an American war, I think Iraq and Afghanistan ought to get 5 or 10 minutes on every news show. And I've said that on the Fox Newswatch. There ought to be a steady diet. Whatever the news is, good, bad, ugly, it ought to be out there. However, from a news junkie point of view, at a different level, not worrying about the fate of the country, just worrying about the entertainment value of the news, this was a great story. And I think that nobody can accuse Katie Couric of being some conservative shill. I think they just understood that a chance to sort of replay the 2004 election with the kind of aura of blood and sacrifice and war and the politics of Iraq, I think it just proved irresistible. And I think, and I wrote this in my column, I think this, any chance, and there wasn't much, that Kerry would ever be president ended in this week.
I don't disagree with you there. I think that by the very fact that he had to pull himself off the campaign trail is an impossible position for anyone who wants to represent Democrats again. I didn't think his campaign was ever going to go anywhere. I don't think he had much in the way of financial support waiting for him. There's no hue and cry for another Kerry campaign, but this really is going to make that delusion even more difficult for anyone to hold on to. I think we've beaten this horse as much as we can. Let's jump off it into the muck of Iraq. The news coming out of Iraq the past few days, despite Tony Snow's best efforts, seems to be bad, bad, and worse. You have the Iraqi police force becoming the people who train them. U.S. Army officers told the Washington Post this week that the police force is nothing more than an extension of the militia. You have the Speaker of the House, the Speaker of the Parliament in Iraq, beating up members for showing up late. You have the casualty count going up and up on the civilian side as well. You have that story in the New York Times yesterday that there was a central command briefing a couple weeks ago when they said Iraq was moving more towards chaos than towards peace. I am hard-pressed to, you know, to see any positive trend lines, and I think that at the end of the day, the election on Tuesday, and we'll get to that more in detail, is going to reflect these bitter realities.
Well, I don't, frankly, disagree I have no positive news to throw in the mix here. I think that the United States, in terms of future such interventions, we ought to pause and realize we're sort of fighting both sides of a civil war. It would be like the French and the English coming to Gettysburg in 1863 and fighting both, General Meade and Robert E. Lee. We should, if we think we know who the good guys are in Iraq, then we should side with them and help the good guys crush the bad guys. If we don't think there are any good guys, then the chances of us helping the good guys win are, by definition, zero. I think a lot of what's the only thread of good news running through Iraq these days is the increasing perception that I'm sure you're covering more closely than I am, that the Baker-Hamilton Commission is leading towards some kind of sanitized, euphemized exit strategy. I mean, what are you hearing, David?
Well, I saw Baker a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him, if they were going to be able to put out something that would be concrete, rather than just sort of some guidelines and vague recommendations about reconciliation and, strategic, redeployment. And he said, that's the whole point. The whole point is to really propose something that can be implemented, that can be debated, and be open to amendment and change and tinkering. And so at the end of the day, though, it remains to be seen what they're going to do. And, of course, the president is under no obligation to accept anything that Baker says. I've been saying this privately, and I'll say it now publicly, perhaps for the first time, that to me, we're seeing, we could be in the beginning of a sort of a bad Shakespearean melodrama. Prince Hal has grown up, gone from being irresponsible to being commander-in-chief, and a bad commander-in-chief. He has got us stuck, as John Kerry would say, in a pretty bad situation in Iraq. And so even though his father, through surrogates, James Baker and Brent Scowcroft, advised against this, and his father quite consciously, when he was in power, chose not to engage in this sort of war, Bush went right ahead, and now the adults, his father, again through the same surrogates, are coming forward to try to save Bush's bacon and come up with a reasonable way out that will be bipartisan, and that foreign policy experts from the Council on Foreign Relations to Brookings to Center for Strategic International Studies and the Foreign Relations Committee on the Senate, can agree upon. And there is a chance, at the end of the day, that Bush, with Dick Cheney by his side, might tell them all to get lost. That he's going to stick it out, he's going to dig in his heels, and he's not going to go for anything that doesn't look like total victory. And I don't know what we do at that point in time. I expect after the election, regardless of whether the Democrats take control or not, that the Republicans on the Hill, who are very uneasy with the war, mainly on the Senate side, but there's some on the House side, will finally start speaking out. They will be unencumbered by political loyalties, and they'll start working with Joe Biden and other Democrats, and in conjunction with whatever the Baker Commission is doing, to try to plot an exit strategy. And so we could well look at, the mother of all political melodramas in this city. If you have the establishment, so to speak, and the older Bush clan of, which you are part of in a way, coming up with a course of action in Iraq. And the rebel commander-in-chief, as Fred Barnes might call him, saying, I am not taking your advice.
For the benefit of our viewers, I worked in the Bush 41 White House, and so was around, admittedly, in the domestic policy end of things for the Gulf War. And I certainly remember zero enthusiasm among sort of the Ben Scowcroft and for that matter, Condi Rice, right. Phil Zelikow, people like that who were floating around the NSC 15 years ago, zero enthusiasm on their part for nation building. which stayed true as for the Bush family dogma through the 2000 campaign, when George W. Bush said no nation building. He actually, you know, as everybody remembers, criticized Al Gore for being for nation building in places like Haiti. And of course, then we tried it in Iraq, in a place at 10 times larger. I mean, I will concede the possibility that Bush and having just said that Cheney and Rumsfeld will stay with him, and I mean Cheney sort of legally has to, but Rumsfeld could get fired any moment. Mm-hmm. If, as Bush said yesterday, I guess it was, that he'll keep Rumsfeld for the next 2 years. That does support your case, David, that the president has a kind of defiance about this that may well be impermeable to the best political machinations of such master political machinators as Jim Baker and Joe Biden. However, the politics get tricky here, because if it comes to be the situation where President Bush is forced out of Iraq somehow because of congressional threats to cut funding or something like that, then you'll set in motion a stab in the back legend. That's a specific reference to the German word Dolchstoss legend. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. But anyway, it had a very specific meaning in 1920s Germany, where it was alleged that Jews and others had sort of caused Germany to lose the war. And again, I don't want to throw around too many loaded references, but it does seem to me that the situation you're describing, where it's a lonely Shakespearean president, at the campfire, doing soliloquies about his fallen empire, surrounded by by a bunch of senators and congressmen, all telling him to get out of Iraq. That may succeed in ending the Iraq War, but the future stab in the back politics of that scenario, I think, would be extremely potent come 2008 and beyond.
Well, listen, the president has already said several times that there will be troops in Iraq through his presidency, thus signaling that whatever the end game or solution is to the mess there, it will be left to others, which means that when this finally ends, and it may well end badly, Bush will not be around to take or accept the blame. And if it ends badly on someone else's watch, well, then he and other advocates of the war will always be able to, blame those people and say they blew it. Everything was, was going fine, or at least wasn't terrible up until this point. And we'll have a who lost Iraq debate, the way we had over China and Vietnam in years past. I mean, Bush ran for office as the responsibility guy, and he's going to leave office, giving the responsibility for dealing with Iraq to somebody else. And my belief is at this point in time that I don't see a good ending one way or the other, whether we pull out or stay in. And Bush will be in the clear when it comes to the final blame game.
Well, that right. is a perfectly plausible scenario. And I just add, as big as the Iraq news is now, in terms of we're talking about it, everybody's talking about right. it, the war's going on, future events in Iran, Pakistan, and so on may yet turn all this, horrible as it is, into a footnote.
Oh, well, sure. And, any sort of attack on the U.S. again, any nuclear act abroad, or God forbid here, would supersede the Iraq War. But it is, let's use that as a very deft transition here until what's happening on Tuesday. It does seem that this war has completely and utterly shaped the campaign, and that the administration failed in its strategic objective, which was quite obvious in the beginning of September, to make this election about the war on terrorism as something defined differently than the war in Iraq. And you and viewers will remember that Bush gave a couple speeches in early September and tried to set up a fight with Democrats on the detention and interrogation bill, and said the speech has worked a little bit. He had an uptick in the polls, but he ended up with a fight with John McCain, John Warner, and Lindsey Graham, three Republican senators, and wasn't able to portray those weak-kneed Democrats as wimps on the war on terrorism. The Foley scandal happened soon after, and Iraq just won't go away. And last week, you know, Bush took one more stab at least neutralizing the Iraq issue by claiming there would be benchmarks. He then refused to explain what those benchmarks would be, what would happen if they didn't meet the benchmarks. And the very next day, Prime Minister Maliki said, benchmarks, we don't need your stinking benchmarks. And Rumsfeld almost said exactly the same thing. So do you see this election as anything other than, if not a referendum on the war in Iraq, a expression of the voting public's unease caused primarily by the war in Iraq?
I think it is, and that's why the elections will probably go badly for the Republicans, because I think the trend of the last 10 or 15 years, or longer than that, has been sort of in a basic kind of conservative center-right direction. And for that to change, I think it would be some sort of shock to the system, like the Iraq War and the unpopularity of it, as obviously we see all over the news, and I think that a race to watch that's sort of emblematic of the changes in the election and frankly the changes inside the Democratic Party is here in the D.C. area, which is the Virginia Senate race.
Right.
Where Jim Webb is exactly what the Democrats would never think about nominating for president, and not even very popular among Democrats until recently. He's an ex-Republican who was with certifiably conservative, sexist views on defense, on women in the military, and all sorts of stuff. And only after the Democrats have lost so many elections in a row and been so clearly in the hole on national security issues reach back to the previous segment and say, because people like John Kerry have kind of defined the Democratic message, and people from Massachusetts, finally the Democrats in Virginia were smart enough collectively to produce a hawkish guy who, by coincidence, or maybe it wasn't coincidence, wrote a book about the fighting history of the Scots-Irish, which is to say the old base of the Democratic Party in the South, which was sort of the middle lower class Scots-Irish, for him to write a book praising them and talking about their role in history as belligerent combatants and the spearheads of all our wars, for that guy to now be a Democrat with a son having been a Vietnam veteran himself, which is, again, is more than we can say about most of the Republicans in anywhere in power these days, including George Allen, and to have to have a son who's currently, as I understand it, in Iraq, is pretty astonishing. And if he wins, I think not only will that be a defeat for the Republicans in terms of their prospects for holding the majority, but it'll be a remarkable signal to Democrats, hey, listen, if you want to win in southern states, find more Jim Webbs.
Let's not forget Makaka. I mean, everything you say, I don't disagree with, Jim. But all this was true 2-3 months ago as well. And Jim Webb's campaign was flagging. He, George Allen had $12 million to his $1 million in campaign treasury. Webb was being cast aside as a lousy and unenthusiastic campaigner. The Democrats, the national Democrats, were saying, "Oh my God, why did we do this?" It was really George Allen's shots at his own feet. With Makaka, the way he handled his reaction to the news that he was partly Jewish. The other day, one of his guys tackled a blogger. The stories about his use of the N-word years ago. All of this has just brought out the inner boobishness of George Allen, which, fortunately for Democrats, Webb has risen to the opportunity that Allen has provided him. But all those things that you said before, in and of themselves, were not enough for the Democrats to talk about taking the seat of the Confederacy. But now Allen has almost, not quite, a few days left, he's almost handed it to them on a on a plate with a Confederate flag emblem. And we'll see. I still think it's going to be rather close. Now, my sense is that the teeming masses of blogginghead viewers out there are just dying for us to play that typical game, and they're calling for predictions. Do you care to make
it? Let me tell you something. Since we're in this new media here, let me just take the Bloggingheads TV audience back to the old media, known as television, back 1986. I was watching the McLaughlin Group, which, David, you remember back then was the show in terms of punditical everything. And this was before Fox, it was before Capital Gang. Mm-hmm. It just was the show to watch. I remember I used to watch it twice and take notes and stuff. I mean, because it's so important in terms of the political debate. It, on the weekend before the 86 midterms, the Republicans were going in the 53 seats. Into that midterm, and all five of the giants of journalism on McLaughlin that week were asked, what's your prediction? And the range they had was between a net change of zero from 53 to a net of -3. And I was working for Vice President Bush back then, and I remember thinking to myself, well, if the Republicans lose three and it's at 50-50, that means that Vice President Bush will be stuck in the Senate all time, breaking ties. He'll be sitting there with Majority Leader, at least Republican Leader, Bob Dole, and there'll be weird body language because they're both running for the 88 nomination, and they'll be on C-SPAN doing stuff together, and who knows what'll happen. And of course, so I wasted 4 days considering all those angles, and then Election Day 86 rolls around, and the Republicans don't lose zero, they don't lose three, they lose eight. And of course, any discussion of whether the Republicans were the majority was therefore wiped out. And ever since then, I've said, okay, look, this pundit business about, everybody wants a crystal ball. Everybody wants a wizard who will tell them the future and so on and so on. My bad news to the Bloggingheads viewers is I just have been burned so many times on this prediction business that I won't do it. However, David, you are free to stake your position out there, and the BHTV audience will either reward you or curse you in a few days, depending on how you do. So go ahead, have at it.
24 seats in the House, tied in the Senate. No, I'm with you. That's not a serious prediction, unless of course it comes true.
Well, wait a second. Can we take it out of context and use it?
Well, feel free to take it out of context. That's what Blogging at TV is all about, taking it out of context. After the 2000 election, I did give up political predictions. I've actually been kind of pessimistic, if I want to use a value-laden term here, about the Democratic chances for months. I kept thinking that the Republicans, look at it this way, the Democrats need 15 seats to win the House. If 50 seats are in play in the House of Representatives, of only 435, it shows, we're only talking about a little more than 10%. If 50 seats are in play, the Democrats have to win 38 out of the 50 to pick up the 15-seat majority gain they need to win the majority. So that means the Republicans only need to win 13, 14 or so of those races. And I figure that Corove and Ken Melman and the guys who raised the money for the GOP are just so good and so strong that they could find, those seats and build up strategic beachheads and port the wave at those particular spots and squeak by with a very narrow victory. Charlie Cook, who I've seen on TV, I've seen in person a few times in the last few weeks, has just convinced me that the wave seems to be getting, at least until the last few days, to be getting bigger and bigger, to such an extent that that the genius of Corove may just not be enough, and that you can only fiddle with the macro picture, by 1 to 2, maybe if you're really good, 3 points. But if the wave is a 5 to 7 point size wave, then it doesn't matter what you do. So I've had to sort of very begrudgingly given up my skepticism about the Democratic chances in the House. Although when I look at the Senate races, it seems to me that it's looking increasingly more difficult. I mean, No one thought the Democrats could do this a couple months ago, and then they got their hopes up. But the Tennessee race in particular looks difficult. The race in Montana, according to the polls, Conrad Burns, who has had his problems with Jack Abramoff, seems to be tightening. It shows you how things can change. People thought that the Webb victory might be the victory that puts the Democrats over the edge in the Senate. But indeed, there may be other Senate seats that they don't get. So it could end up falling a seat or two shy.
But on election day, I mean, I think that there's three or four issues. I think we may talk about these. I think will loom large in the 110th Congress. Bush's last 2 years. One will be immigration. One will be the Iraq War. We've kind of talked about that. Yeah. And I think a third one that, and again, as the news continues to bubble out of North Korea, will be missile defense. I think that those issues, and to me, those three all has a lot to do with a redefinition of American homeland security or national security, and maybe a useful exercise for America would be to once again combine the idea of national security and homeland security into the same idea, instead of national security being defined increasingly as like strange foreign wars in faraway places, and then homeland security is done by something else. Maybe we could have the Defense Department defend America again. Whereupon issues like immigration and missile defense, I think, will become front and center. I think that even Nancy Pelosi, who might not exactly, shall we say, have strong instincts toward something as prosaic as immigration control or missile defense, may find yourself forced to think again about those issues, in part because of pressure from people like Jim Webb, if he's a senator.
Well, I think it's going to be very interesting to look at immigration. I think if the Democrats gain control of one or both bodies in Congress, they're going to have more. They're going to have to take more of a lead in coming up with an immigration bill of some sort. And you have, as you all know, these contrasting dynamics in both parties between, different approaches. And you could end up with a real sort of motley crew of alliances in whatever happens with immigration. I'm surprised that I actually expected Republicans to make more of the immigration issue than they have in the election now. My hunch is that the polling is showing that that Americans are far more conflicted, that most Americans are far more conflicted about immigration and the right way to proceed than some of the hardcore Republicans would have us believe, or the talk show hosts would indicate. And thus it's going to be very hard, I think, threading the needle on some of this stuff and coming up with the right political formulations to get something that could actually pass.
But see, David, this is the difference between Democrats and Republicans. You have to give a five-minute answer where you mention all these nuances and complexities. I think the emerging Republican position will be simply, we're going to build a wall, we're going to say no to guest workers, and we're then just going to proceed on a more tough-minded national security policy. But
they're going to run right into the Chamber of Commerce, and that definitely.
To be honest,
that definitely plays to a certain type of voter. There are a lot of people more conflicted. A lot of people, they're gardeners, they're contractors, the people they see in restaurants who they have tremendously positive interactions with. They're not really in favor of rounding up and shipping back to Mexico, in a 12 million person dragnet.
I didn't say ship back to Mexico. I didn't include that on my list. I said build a wall, no amnesty. I think that the reality of what's going on in Europe now, where if it's sort of hard to believe, but I keep reading it in the papers, it must be true, that 100 cars a night are being torched somewhere in France by mostly, I guess, North African, that level of security challenge to the basic well-being of a country is so severe that I don't think Americans want to repeat that here. And I'm certainly not saying that Mexican Americans are doing that, because they're not, but I think that the rising level of concern about homeland security in a world of terrorism, in a world of rogue countries with nuclear weapons, is going to make being tough on immigration an easy decision for most Republicans and most Americans. And I don't think the Chamber of Commerce will have much of a chance against a mobilized talk radio, Fox News fired up audience on this issue. And I think that if the Democrats want to have a formula for a two-year period of ruling the Congress, I think it's if they continue to side with Teddy Kennedy on a guest worker proposal.
Well, listen, we'll see. I still think, you know, you can't deal with the immigration issue without talking about those 12 million people here, because that's really the way I think a lot of people view the issue in those terms, because those are the people they see and interact with.
But remember, the 12 million people are here, David. If the guest worker program is more people on top of them.
Well, I understand. I'm not saying I'm in favor of, you know, of Bush's guest worker program. I'm far more concerned with what you do about the people who are here,
okay.
And you know, I'm finding a way to make that sort of a coherent part of our.
Teddy Kennedy and Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi are for a guest worker.
Well,
program.
I understand that. That doesn't mean that I have to do.
Oh, you're right. I'm just saying that. No, we're talking about the Democrats here as a dilemma they have, which is I think they've let themselves get staked out on the wrong side of this issue badly.
Yeah. But there's no doubt there'll be legislation about toughening up border security, and I think that will be apple pie stuff. Once you get past that, I think it becomes more difficult. You know, you mentioned briefly missile defense. I still think that, you know, that there's a tremendous burden on advocates of missile defense to show that the money spent has been worthwhile and hasn't gone down a rat hole. And until they do that, we'll continue to, you know, squawk about it. I have no problems with, you know, with researching this and spending money on it, but it looks to me like it's just been another government boondoggle, and I just have no confidence whatsoever in the Pentagon's ability to come up with an effective decent program.
How about Israel's ability to come up with a program?
You want to outsource to Israel on this?
Well, I would if I had to, sure. but I'll tell you this. If North Korea goes along, as they seem to be doing, testing nuclear weapons, building bigger missiles, collaborating with the Iranians and who knows who else, and they build a missile defense, missile offense program,
mm-hmm.
What choice do we have?
Well, do you think they're suicidal? That's sort of the basic.
No, I don't think they're suicidal. I think that I don't.
Okay, well then why wouldn't deterrence work?
Well, I'm for deterrence, but what if deterrence fails? What if they do prove to be suicidal? I mean, the point is you can't. I mean, if somebody's sitting here with a gun pointed at you, it behooves you to put on a bulletproof vest. That can't be a bad idea.
Well, if the vest works.
Well,
and if moving doesn't cause the other guy to shoot you at the time when you get the. I mean, that's an easy metaphor. But, you know, we Ronald Reagan started this in 83. There have been lots of promises, and there's been a tremendous amount of fraud and wasted money in this, and we don't have anything to show for it. And, you know, listen, I'm horribly optimistic about North Korea these days, but we do have to, you know, that, you know, at least, you know, it seems a day or two ago that the Chinese scared them sufficiently to bring them back to the six-party talks. And what did we have? We actually had three-party talks. Ambassador Chris Hill met with his counterpart from North Korea and a Chinese official as well early in the week. And so it showed, and I'll give the Bush administration credit for this, a certain amount of flexibility from the we won't talk to you other than in six-party talk position that the Bush administration had stuck to. And it reminds me about over, I don't know, a year and a half ago, I was at a reception. I was talking to Chris Hill. And it was when they seemed to have reached a point where they might have had a deal with the North Koreans. It didn't hold. But he was saying, "Yeah, I finally, you know, got those guys to see some sense." And someone said, "The North Koreans?" He said, "No, the White House. They're letting me talk to the North Koreans." Pressure on the Chinese. Well, from the Chinese, will slow this thing down a bit.
But let me ask you a question, David. This is for our blogger head. Yeah. Audience can have some fun with our predictions. I will predict that it's more likely that Japan and South Korea go nuclear than it is likely that North Korea goes denuclear.
I'm trying to think. If one happens, then the other won't happen. If a lot of happens, then the.
You can disentangle if you want to, but I'll take my package prediction. I'll put it another way, more baldly. I think that now South Korea and Japan are on a track toward becoming nuclear powers.
Well, they certainly are.
Right, and therefore all the more reason why, since we can't preempt all these countries, and we can't guarantee they'll always like us, I think all the more reason for us to think about defending ourselves, whether it's immigration at the most prosaic level of building a wall. or a more sort of, you know, avant-garde Astrodome in the sky somewhere.
Well,
I think they're both exactly the proper responses to a world where, almost without regard to anything the United States does or doesn't do,
Jim,
other countries are playing their own superpower game.
Jim, but the bottom line is, this stuff has to work. I mean, there are physicists who say it's virtually impossible to have a system with any degree of confidence in terms of missile defense. The wall that they've passed legislation on apparently is going through terrain where you can't build a wall of the type that they are that they're almost funding. I mean, so the bottom line is, you know, walls, if there is a way to protect ourselves, sure, but it has to work. And if it doesn't, the current President Bush in 2001 gave a speech and said, I will not deploy a missile defense system unless it works. And then he started deploying a system in Alaska before it was even tested to show it could work. I mean, so that's the bottom line here.
Well, you might recall how we fought World War II, in which we started building the Oak Ridge nuclear facility and the facility in New Mexico. We had no idea the A-bomb would work. We just started doing it anyway.
Well, listen.
I mean there's lots of weapons. Almost, I would argue just about every weapon has been started before anybody knew it would work or not. But what happens is, as you work on it, lo and behold, it does work.
Well, so far we've worked on missile defense for 23-plus years now, and it hasn't.
And how long did we work on airplanes before we figured out how to make an airplane work?
Well,
centuries. Leonardo da Vinci had a design in the 16th
your
century.
Your example of the atomic bomb is rather instructive here. That took 3 years, four
well,
years.
Well, it took 3 years and about 10% of the U.S. GDP paying for it. I mean, we had an enormous command concentration on...
Listen, you don't get an argument from me. I don't mind researching this stuff, but I think the program... has really been, you know, the contractors have taken advantage of it, and it's been a tremendous amount of waste. And, you know, if it can be proven to work, sure.
Okay.
The Russians don't seem to mind that. And then I would do what Reagan said. I would share it with everybody. Everybody has an interest in stopping nuclear weapons.
I agree. By the way, for the Blogging Heads audience, I wrote a piece in June of 2001, 3 months before 9/11,
yeah,
in which I called for a world anti-rogue nations organization. And I actually quoted a Democratic member of Congress, Rob Andrews from New Jersey, saying that, yeah, that's exactly what we ought to have, some international consortium on missile defense for exactly this reason.
Now, let's stay in space for a moment, because I know you're a space maven, so to speak. And other news this week was that NASA is finally acceding to the pleas of astronomers around the world and will be sending a team to fix the Hubble telescope. Were you elated by that?
I was elated by that, and I was very moved by listening to those astronauts, the people who will be going up on actually flying the shuttle, saying, listen, if I die, get blown up in some tragic accident doing this, I will think of my life as having been worth it. I mean, I think that's exactly the right spirit of inquiry and exploration and so on that animated all the explorers, many of whom, of course, lost their lives in the course of exploring the oceans and Arctics and Antarctics and so on and so on. So the notion that people would risk their lives for the betterment of human knowledge, I found almost brought a tear to my eye, because I am, in fact, a big proponent of space travel and wish the Hubble Space Telescope the best.
Well, I liked it too, because I do think I'm not a big fan of Bush's mission to Mars program, which you realize he hasn't talked about now in a couple of years after making a big deal of it. I don't even remember which State of the Union speech it was.
It was 2004.
In 2004, yeah. He quickly dropped it when showing you how committed he is to his big bold ideas. But what I think is good about this decision is that it does show that NASA is taking seriously the science, the research side of its mission, and learning about the origins of the universe and our own planet, which Hubble helps. I think it's worthwhile, and I'm much more keen on that than I am on setting meeting these markers of having to get someone to Mars at a certain point in time.
But don't you think it's a good idea to put human beings in other places in the solar system?
Well, maybe in Utah. I mean, in general, I grew up a big fan of this. I love it. I think it's neat. But I do think it's a question of priorities as well. And Right now I lean more on the science and research side of things than I am about, you know, man or woman space exploration, as much as I just get a thrill out of that for the entertainment value.
Okay. Well, I do think that, not unlike what happened in the 60s with the Apollo program, that the unpopular foreign war has a way of draining away resources for things. It happened then, and it is happening now.
Well, give me a choice between Iraq and sending Richard Pearl to Mars. I know which one I'll choose. The latter.
Okay.
The amount of money that, you know, that we spend on Iraq is actually quite enormous, and there's just so many other fanciful things that we wouldn't even bother thinking about funding that we could have funded with the same dollars. We've gone from Washington to the far reaches of the solar system here. Any parting thoughts before we leave? Because you and I probably won't be talking again before the coming election.
Hopefully we'll talk before the second anniversary of blogging STV. All I can say is that, you know, I think that this technology that we're a part of here and that Liz Wu here at the New America Foundation has been a great help on, and, you know, and so on, and Jerry Irvine and everybody else who works here. I mean, this is an exciting opportunity for all of us who've been lucky enough to be part of Bob and Mickey's idea of, we're going to take communication to its next obvious logical level. I think that everybody with a message, and that includes people who work for magazines and people who work for newspapers and people who work at think tanks, ought to be wrestling around with this stuff and experimenting with these cameras and technologies and so on, because the one thing I've learned in the pundit business is if you can't make your product entertaining and fun, and it's certainly fun to do these things with David, with you, and with others on Blogging STV, and hopefully it's fun for the audience to watch. And if a year from now we haven't figured out a way to evolve it further, we've got graphics or some sort of other, you know, technology as part of this, then we haven't done our job, and we'll lose to somebody who does, because out there in the YouTube world, people are dreaming this stuff up and getting creative, and it's quite a treat now to go to read, to go see what somebody came up with on YouTube, as opposed to like opening up the op-ed page of some newspaper.
I second those remarks, and I want to thank Bob and Mickey for getting the ball rolling, and also, you know, can't wait for Google to come along and buy up Blogging Heads TV. We'll be very wealthy. I'll see you soon in this very small but exciting new media.
Thank you, David. Bye-bye.
Bye.